Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The forecast is for more rain in Myanmar. It's the last thing the cyclone-ravaged country needs. What it does need is more humanitarian aid, if only the government there would allow it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. And by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 9th day of May. It's been a week since that massive cyclone swamped the nation of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. So far, the International Red Cross says aid efforts have reached only 220,000 of the nearly 2 million survivors in need. The UN's World Food Program plans to send in two more relief flights tomorrow, despite the lack of cooperation from the military dictatorship. From Washington, John Dimsdale reports international relief agencies are scrambling to figure out how to deal with the country's xenophobic rulers.
The military dictatorship fears an influx of relief workers will expose the regime's economic failures and encourage pro-democracy agitators. But Andrew Natsios, the former administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development and now a professor at Georgetown University, says by slowing the humanitarian response, Myanmar's rulers are acting against their own self-interests.
Oddly enough, natural disasters can have profound political implications in countries that don't respond to them well. There's frequently regime changes that take place, and so by delaying the response, they're actually making themselves much more vulnerable to political unrest.
Tensions are rising as Burmese people line up for food and fuel, which have tripled in price since the cyclone. Natsios recommends sending vouchers to cyclone victims that can be cashed in at local food and furniture shops. Such vouchers would have violated U.S. sanctions against Myanmar's government, but shortly after the cyclone, the Treasury Department lifted a ban on sending money to Myanmar. Before that, U.S. sanctions had constrained relief operations, says CareUSA's Leslie Shad.
We definitely were not soliciting for broad Myanmar funding because we were afraid that if we open our arms to Myanmar funding, we would get things we couldn't actually program.
Shad hopes the easing of U.S. sanctions will allow CARE to use donations on such things as micro-lending development programs in Myanmar. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Another day, another record price for oil, $126 a barrel and counting. Today's pain comes courtesy of Venezuela. Or rather, news that leftist President Hugo Chavez may have closer ties than initially suspected with the Colombian terrorist group FARC. Reports in the Wall Street Journal raised fears of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, which provides a big chunk of our oil supply. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The U.S. buys more than 1 million barrels of oil a day from Venezuela, 11% of U.S. daily consumption. If it were to label Venezuela a state sponsor of terrorism, that could lead to economic sanctions and halt this critical flow of oil.
Well, unfortunately, the timing couldn't be worse.
That's analyst Patrick Estaduelas with the Eurasia Group. He says the stalled U.S. economy simply can't afford to provoke higher oil prices.
It's neither in the U.S.'s economic interest nor is it in its political interest to take as hard a measure as imposing sanctions against Venezuela.
A Senate Foreign Relations Committee report last week drew a similar conclusion. It said unilateral sanctions on Venezuela could backfire, hurting U.S. commercial interests and isolating the U.S. in Latin America. Sanctions are just the latest concern as record oil prices rattle U.S. consumers. Just in time for the summer travel season, the three biggest U.S. airlines have raised round-trip fares by $20 to cover higher fuel costs. The fuel surcharge now exceeds the ticket price on some cheaper routes. Richard Abulafia is an analyst with the Teal Group.
People are going to travel less and demand is going to go down. The broader economic term is basically stagflation, stagnant demand and inflated costs.
Fuel buyers aren't the only ones feeling the squeeze. Oil giant Chevron is laying off 1,100 workers because of shrinking margins in its refinery business. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The deserts of Saudi Arabia are, of course, rich in oil. But oil won't feed a growing population. That's where food imports come in. The Saudis are one of the world's top purchasers of rice. But with the prices surging and supplies shrinking, they've struck upon a new solution. Buy up productive agricultural land elsewhere. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
This week, Saudi Arabia announced plans to invest in overseas fisheries, livestock, and food production, and is reportedly trying to partner with Thai rice farms to lock in future supplies. Libya is in talks with Ukraine about growing wheat there. And as China tries to feed its expanding middle class, it's looking to buy up farmland in Africa and South America. Commodities analyst Richard Feltus with MF Global says for decades, these countries relied on cheap and abundant world surpluses to meet their food needs.
That is all shifting now. We're going from just-in-time delivery to what I call just-in-case reserves.
That's because some two dozen food-rich nations, from Argentina to Vietnam, recently imposed export restrictions on staples like soybeans and rice to stem inflation at home. And that has countries like Saudi Arabia fearing the worst. Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock.
They are faced with the choice of either paying a very exorbitant price for a limited amount of food that's actually traded on world markets, or they think that maybe if they secure their own supplies that they can have first call on those supplies if they own the farmland and the means of production.
That is, if they can afford it. Oxfam America's Gawain Kripke says most food importing countries don't have that luxury.
And if global supply keeps getting locked up by special arrangements, they'll have less and less food to access in global markets,
causing even more food inflation in countries where the poorest already spend up to 75% of their income on daily meals. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
In a 3.5-hour meeting with investors today, Citigroup said it plans to shed up to $500 billion worth of assets over the next 5 years. It's part of an effort that includes more job cuts, and it's all to make up for massive losses in the credit markets. On Wall Street, $126 crude prompted a 120-point drop on the Dow. Details when we talk to that guy down in Dallas. Years ago, a German pharmaceutical company introduced a drug called thalidomide. It was supposed to help pregnant women cope with morning sickness. Instead, it left thousands of babies dead or severely deformed. Victims and their families received millions of dollars in compensation. But now, many of those thalidomide babies are middle-aged. Their health is deteriorating, and the money is running out. Today, two British victims are in Germany to launch the latest stage in a campaign for more generous payback. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Thalidomide left Carl Davis disabled from birth. His arms are little more than hands protruding from his shoulders. But that doesn't stop Carl from trying to lead a normal life.
I'm using my foot to put the key in and turn. OK, that's on. Now it's shoe back on.
In spite of his disability, Carl drives himself to work.
Now I'll use my foot to hook underneath the door and I'll just slam the door and pull my foot out and leg out of the way rather quickly so I don't get caught.
An adroit performance, but Carl admits that at the age of 45, it isn't getting easier.
It's getting increasingly difficult over the years. Flexibility's gone. My hands aren't as flexible or as strong as they used to be, and things are more painful year by year by year.
And more expensive. When they were born, the thalidomide victims were not expected to live more than a few years. Now many of them, more severely disabled than Carl, have outlived their compensation. They've launched a campaign to get more money. They've targeted the German manufacturer of the drug, Grünenthal, and the German government.
They have not lived up to their moral obligation, and eventually we will sit down and negotiate a settlement which will make the thalidomide financially secure.
Nick Dobrik, himself a moderately disabled thalidomider, is heading the campaign. He's asking for $6 billion, an average of $1.75 million for each of the 3,500 surviving victims. Grünenthal has rejected that claim and agreed only to pay an extra $75 million. the German government has proved unresponsive. When Nick and his fellow campaigners turned up on the doorstep of the German embassy in London last month, the ambassador's deputy was not exactly welcoming.
Physically can't see you today.
You don't seem to care about them.
No, that's not correct.
Well,
that's not correct at all.
Grünenthal paid the equivalent of $200 million to the German victims of the drug in the early 70s. But that money's run out. The German government now pays the German victims an average of $8,000 a year. Jacqueline Perry is a British lawyer who's working pro bono for the thalidomiders. She says the business of compensation has changed dramatically since the early 70s.
We calculated in a much more exacting way than was ever done in the days when a sort of general figure was thought of. You looked at the ceiling, you gazed out of the window, you divided by three, and it was a very much less scientific basis.
Thalidomide victims in Spain and Italy got no compensation at all. The US largely avoided the disaster. The FDA refused to approve the drug. But there are thought to be about a dozen American victims whose mothers took the medicine while in Europe. We don't know whether any of them were compensated. Lorraine Mercer is another British victim. She has no arms or legs. She lives alone in a small apartment surrounded by electronic devices.
This is the electric door mechanism into Lorraine's apartment. It's an automatic system which is radio.
Robert is a part-time carer. In spite of Lorraine's severe disability, in spite of the fact that British victims are better off than most, she doesn't get full-time care. She can't afford it.
Not easy, very hard to survive on your own.
Once she sang in the church choir, but breathing trouble has crushed her vocal cords. Her health is declining fast, but she's completely committed to the campaign.
I will go and fight. If they don't give us more money, I will go and fight until we get somewhere.
The victims intend their new campaign to be a landmark in the history of product liability and compensation. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson in Dallas. And my friend, I guess it is not April anymore.
No. In fact, you know, maybe it's time to play this game again that we play sometimes.
Oh, I like games.
Sell in May and go away.
Yeah, you know, but I wish I had sold at the end of April before this week came to us.
Yeah, well, or, you know, come to think of it, back in October would have been a good
time.
Well,
that would have been much better, yes.
I don't know. You know, this is just screwy. Now, take today, for example. So the billboard is another triple-digit loss on Wall Street as the Dow plunges 120 points.
Yeah.
And it was every bit that bad. But then you look at the numbers. Well, there were 1,432 stocks up. There were 1,639 stocks down. I mean, there were only 200 more down than up.
Only.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I owned all 1,400 or 1,639 that were down.
That were down, yeah.
Yeah, and oil. I mean, the drumbeat of oil 5 days in a row. It just, you know, it's just enough to make you wish there was a weekend nearby.
Yes, well, fortunately there is. And you mentioned oil hitting, what, $126 a barrel today. But Goldman Sachs came out earlier this week and predicted that we may soon, by the end of the year, see $150, $200 a barrel.
You know, I want to, let me just pause a minute and thank you for reminding me of that day.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Now, that was Wednesday. And I tell you, it was just, it was like everything came down on us on Wednesday. And it really set the stage for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday trading and the fact that we couldn't get a turn. So you had that and as oil went up Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, those drumbeats got ever louder. Then we had this housing bill, which was seen as a panacea. The president was talking about, you know, vetoing that.
Well, and Wednesday also seemed to be the day that we started hearing potential bad news about AIG, and indeed today, a report of a $7.8 billion loss. Is this ever going to end?
Yeah, everybody knew those earnings were coming, yeah. And everybody had a sense they were going to be bad. And we just needed to get through one round of not having some numbers that were even worse than expected. And obviously, we didn't do that.
Well, let me ask you about one thing, though. We also had figures this week showing that consumer credit, people are spending more money.
Well, yeah, and we've seen a lot of that. But this one was really deep, and this is the one that I think may reverberate around, is that consumers borrowed at the strongest rate in I think it was 4 months.
Yeah.
Outstanding credit up $12 or $15 billion. And you worry at some point, you know, you cross over and it's not just spending money on, you know, extravagant items, big screen TVs, but it's when you have to use those credit cards to buy milk and eggs and gasoline. That's the sign that it's really getting bad, and that's what you don't want to see.
All right, David, time to go home. It is Friday.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, David. David Johnson in Dallas. Coming up, families struggle to keep their stomachs full.
Anything that you come across, you eat a bread, two slices of bread at times. When there's no bread, it's tea, then you sleep. Then the next morning, you think about something else.
But first, let's do the numbers. Renewed credit fears and new record oil prices made for a gloomy session on Wall Street. The Dow staggered 0.9%, 120 points, to close at 12,745. The Nasdaq clicked down 0.25%, 5 points, to close at 2,445. The S&P gave back 0.2%, 9 points, to end the day at 1,388. For the week, the Dow tumbled 2.3%, the Nasdaq dropped 1.3%, the S&P 500 was off 1.8%. We mentioned the world's largest insurer, American International Group, AIG, spooked the street with its second straight quarterly loss. Its stock faltered 8.75%. Citigroup forfeited 2.75%. Bonds rose and the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888 Vanguard. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for April. It's going to cost you more to mail a letter. First-class postage goes up to 42 cents. Stock up on one-center stamps now. And on May 12, 1978, the Commerce Department decided to stop naming hurricanes solely after women. A step toward gender equality? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal.
In Haiti, deadly riots over food prices.
Costco is now limiting purchases of rice and
winter wheat in Kansas City's up 25 cents. Corn.
During the Great Depression, food riots broke out in the U.S. In Minneapolis, hungry people smashed store windows to grab meat, fruit, and canned goods. Similar riots are now sweeping the African continent. Today, as part of our series, Food Fight, a look at the global food crisis, we focus on who is suffering. It's not just the poor. More people in the middle class are having trouble feeding themselves. We have two stories about this new face of hunger. Gretchen Wilson reports from South Africa, where home gardening has become a necessity. But first, Sean Cole visits a family in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, outside St. Paul.
Jen Peterson is a candidate for city council, and early last week, she and her 8-year-old daughter Harley and I all piled into her minivan for a drive to the local food shelf.
The Friends in Need food shelf in St. Paul Park.
This wasn't a campaign stop. She was dropping by to pick up some food for her family. It was just her second visit this year.
But I see a trend developing.
In your life?
Yeah, in this need.
Jen knows that trend well. When she was a single mom with four kids, she had to lean on all kinds of state aid. She and her current husband, Tony, both work two jobs. And after a big child support settlement in 2004, they were able to make do without assistance.
So we were, you know, living pretty happy, middle class, dual income parents.
Except both Tony and Jen's ex are in the building industry. And after the foreclosure crisis hit, she found herself back at the food shelf for the first time in 4 years.
It's just hard to keep the cupboards full without having to spend more and more money. And this is, you know, the food shelf is the one way that we can supplement that. Ready to go in?
Yep, but I need a ponytail.
Oh, I don't think I have a ponytail.
The Friends in Need food shelf looks like a cross between a community center and a fallout shelter. It's filled with boxes and bottles and cans and very, very nice people, one of whom handed Jen a clipboard when we walked in.
All right. You want to look at the list with me and see if there's anything we don't need?
I don't think we need SpaghettiOs.
Oh, no, we need SpaghettiOs.
Seriously?
Yeah, we don't need any canned peas.
I don't like peas.
I know, I don't either.
Eventually, the volunteers rolled out a shopping cart with four bags of groceries in it. Cereal, spaghetti, paper towels.
Ooh, look at that, reduced fat Cheez-Its. Woohoo! That is awesome.
Reduced fat anything is a luxury when you're short on food dollars, which is the kind of thing that some families in the area are just learning.
This morning, in the first 10 minutes, we had five new families that have never been to a food shelf before.
Michelle Regith is executive director of the Friends in Need food shelf. She says some of the newer families are embarrassed about having to rely on charity.
We have a lot of people who find it difficult to come in because they say, I've contributed for the last 15 years. I never dreamed I'd be
They've given food.
Oh, of course.
And now they have to take the food.
Yes, and they didn't expect to ever be in that position.
And according to Hunger Solutions, which runs the Food Shelf Network in Minnesota, there was a big spike in visits about 6 months before the foreclosure crisis hit.
Sometimes food shelf usage starting to go up is a little bit of the canary in the mine shaft.
Colleen Mariardi is executive director of Hunger Solutions. She says food shelf visits have increased 60% since 2000. And most of the clients who come by now are employed.
The tremendous spike is worrisome. The fact that we've now moved from an emergency food system to a way to keep the middle class fed is of great concern to me.
All right, Harley, you see any croutons on sale?
From Friends in Need, Jen and Harley headed to the local supermarket to pick up the rest of their groceries. Jen warned me that we'd probably be there a while.
The lesser amount of money I have to spend, the longer it takes me to shop. Because then I'm really watching the labels and comparing prices.
She wasn't kidding. We spent about an hour in that store, peering at that tiny writing on the price labels that says how much stuff costs by the ounce.
Holy buckets. 43 cents per ounce versus 25 cents per ounce. Okay, store brand won this time.
But in three separate cases, the store brands were actually more expensive than the name brands on sale.
Oh, 9.5 cents per ounce. Wow! I think the brand names are catching on that people don't have money these days to buy groceries, so they're reducing their prices.
At one point, Jen told me she's thinking of growing a garden in her yard this summer.
Just to have some cheap, fresh produce? I don't have a green thumb, but I might have to get one.
Do you have the time to tend a garden?
No, I don't. Especially not with running the campaign.
But Gretchen Wilson talked to somebody who's been doing a lot of gardening in South Africa.
This is the green beans. Here it's the beetroot. This is the green pepper. That's the
For families in the developing world, gardens have become a necessity. In the small town of Motlakeng, Jacob Mokobane planted vegetables in the field of a government high school.
And some of the food here assist me, especially potatoes, tomatoes, you know, to put a decent meal on the table. Yeah.
50-year-old Mokobane used to earn $700 a month working in human resources at a gold mine. He pretty much had a middle-class life, which means he could send his kids to school and be the breadwinner for 50 members of his extended family. But the mine closed down. Now he and a few neighbors sell spinach from this garden. And when there's no food in the cupboard, his family has what he calls patchwork days.
When days are dark, anything that you come across, you eat bread, two slices of bread at times. When there's no bread, it's tea, then you sleep. Then the next morning, you think about something else.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says 36 countries are facing a food crisis. 21 are in Africa. The cost of milk, flour, and bread are sometimes double what they were last year. To get by, some Africans will skip a meal or sell off assets like goats or wheelbarrows or plant food in their yards, like in this one west of Johannesburg.
Then this one, the cabbage is still small, but that one is nearly ready.
Rising food prices have the greatest impact on South Africa's poor and tiny middle class, because compared to richer homes, they spend a bigger chunk of their income on food.
My name is Bertha Tsika. I'm 65 now. I was suffering to buy some vegetables.
Tsika's retired and lives in a tiny house in Bekkersdal, South Africa. She usually spends 80% of her social security check on groceries.
Then I've got three brothers. They don't work. It's only me. I must give them food. Sometimes we were sleeping without food.
Last year, a local government program provided Tsika with some seeds and simple garden tools. She dug up her flower bed to plant green peppers, tomatoes, and carrots.
I'm going to cut the carrots. Then I wash it.
Now she relies on her small plot.
I don't buy cabbage anymore. I don't buy carrots. I don't buy beetroot.
That means her money can be spent on things she can't grow, like milk, tea, even bread for her grandchildren.
Now I can make him a lunch because I can afford to buy bread. Before, I couldn't afford to buy bread.
Tsika says her success has inspired her neighbors to dig up their own yards. Now on this street, roses and manicured lawns have been replaced by corn stalks and cabbages. In Bekkersdal, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
For more stories and pictures from our food series, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, my goodness, the odds are going down of my Guinness coming from the famed brewery at St. James Gate in Dublin. British liquor giant Diageo owns the brand, and today it announced it's laying off more than half of the brewer's workforce in Ireland and closing two breweries. I guess Guinness isn't good for them anymore. Diageo says it'll build a new high-tech brewing facility in the Dublin suburbs and sell half of the St. James property. Let's hope it's not the start of a Guinness cascade. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 120 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq flopped 5 points, 0.25%. And the S&P slumped 9 points, 0.67%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Next time on the program, buying organic in Israel.
He said, "What do you care about who's producing the product? You see, is it good? You like it? So eat it. What do you care? It's none of your business."
I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy your weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.